I'm going to read two stories tonight, one quite short. It's a coincidence, but their titles are, the first story is called Sister, the second story is called The Rich Brother. But really, in the collection to which they belong, which is a new collection, that's the only sort of family titles. It isn't sort of a motif that runs through it. Sister is the shorter of the two. I'll read that first. There was a park at the bottom of the hill. Now that the leaves were down, Marty could see the exercise stations and part of a tennis court from her kitchen window through a web of black branches. She took another donut from the box on the table and ate it slowly, watching the people at the exercise stations, two men and a woman. The woman was doing leg raisers. The men were just standing there. Though the day was cold, one of the men had taken his shirt off, and even from this distance, Marty was struck by the deep brown color of his skin. You hardly ever saw great tans like that on people around here, not even in summer. He had come from somewhere else. She went into the bedroom and put on a running suit and an old pair of Adidas. The seams were giving out, but her other pair was new and their whiteness made her feet look big. She took off her glasses and put her contacts in. Tears welled up under the lenses. For a few moments, she lost her image in the mirror. Then it returned and she saw the excitement in her face, the eagerness. Whoa, she thought. She sat there for a while, feeling the steady thump of the stereo in the apartment overhead. Then she rolled a joint and stuck it in the pocket of her sweatshirt. A dog barked at Marty as she walked down the hallway. It barked at her every time she passed its door, and it always took her by surprise, leaving her fluttery and breathless. The dog was a big shepherd whose owners were gone all the time. She could hear its feet scrabbling and see its nose pushed under the door. Easy, she said. Easy there. But it kept trying to get at her, and Marty heard it barking all the way down the corridor until she reached the door and stepped outside. It was late afternoon and cold, so cold she could see her breath. As always on Sunday, the street was dead quiet, except for the skittering of leaves on the sidewalk as the breeze swept through them and ruffled the cold-looking pools of water from last night's rain. With the trees bare, the sky seemed vast. Two dark clouds drifted overhead, and in the far distance, an angle of geese flew across the sky. Honkers, her brother called them. Right now, he and his buddies would be banging away at them from one of the marshes outside town. By nightfall, they'd all be drunk. She smiled, thinking of that. Marty did a couple of knee bends and headed toward the park, forcing herself to walk against the urge she felt to run. She considered taking a couple of hits off the joint in her pocket, but decided against it. She didn't want to lose her edge. The woman she'd seen at the exercise station was gone, but the two men were still there. Marty held back for a while, did a few more knee bends, and watched some boys playing football on the field behind the tennis courts. They couldn't have been more than 10 or 11, but they moved like men, hunching up their shoulders and shaking their wrists as they jogged back to the huddle, grunting when they came off the line as if their bodies were big and weighty. You could tell that in their heads they had a whole stadium of people watching them. It tickled her. Marty watched them run several plays, then she walked over to the exercise stations. When she got there, she had a shock. Marty recognized one of the men, and she was so afraid he would recognize her that she almost turned around and went home. He was a regular at the Contiki. A few weeks earlier, he had taken notice of Marty, and they'd matched daiquiris for a couple of hours, and things looked pretty good. Then she went out to the car to get this book she'd been describing to him, a book about Edgar Casey and reincarnation. And when she got back, he was sitting on the other side of the room with someone else. He hadn't left anything for the drink, so she got stuck with the bar bill, and her lighter was missing. The man's name was Jack. When she saw him leaning against a chin-up station, she didn't know what to do. She wanted to vanish right into the ground. But he seemed not to remember her. In fact, he was the one who said hello. "Hey there," he said. She smiled at him. Then she looked at the tan one and said, "Hi." He didn't answer. His eyes moved over her for a moment, and he looked away. He'd put on a warm-up jacket with a hood, but left the zipper open nearly to his waist. His chest was covered with little curls of glistening golden hair. The other one, Jack, had on faded army fatigues with dark patches where the insignia had been removed. He needed a shave. He was holding a quart bottle of beer. The two men had been talking when she walked up, but now they were silent. Marty felt them watching her as she did her stretches. They had been talking about sex. She was sure of that. What they'd been saying was still in the air somehow, with the ripe smell of wet leaves and the rain-soaked earth. She took a deep breath. Then she said, "You didn't get that tan around here." She kept rocking back and forth on her knuckles, but looked up at him. "You bet your buns I didn't," he said. "The only thing you get around here is arthritis." He pulled the zipper of his jacket up and down. "Hawaii, Waikiki Beach." "Waikiki," Jack said, "bikining watching capital of the world." "Brother, you speak true," the tan one said. "They've got the special breed over there that they raise just to walk back and forth in front of you. You ought to parachute about 50 of them into Russia. Those old farts in the Kremlin would go out of their skulls. We could just walk in and take the place over." "They could drop a couple on this place while they're at it," Jack said. "Amen," the tan one nodded. "Make it four, two apiece." "Aloha," Marty said. She rolled over on her back and raised her feet a few inches off the ground. She held them there for a moment, then lowered them. "That's all the Hawaiian I know," she said. "Aloha and Maui Zowie. They grow some killer weed over there." "For sure," the tan one said. "It's God's country, sister, and that's a fact." Jack walked up closer. "I know you from somewhere," he said. "Oh no," Marty thought. She smiled at him. "Maybe," she said. "What's your name?" "Bill," he said. "Right," Marty wanted to say. "You bet, Jack." Jack looked down at her. "What's yours?" She raised her feet again. "Elizabeth." "Elizabeth," he repeated slowly, so that it struck Marty how beautiful the name was. "Fairfield," she almost added. But she hesitated, and the moment passed. "I guess not," he said. She lowered her feet and sat up. "A lot of people look like me." He nodded. Just then, something flew past Marty's head. She jerked to one side and threw her hands up in front of her face. She gave a shudder and looked around. "Jesus," she said. "Sorry," someone shouted. "Goddamn frisbees," Jack said. "It's all right," Marty told him, and waved at the man who'd thrown it. She turned and waved again at another man some distance behind her, who was wiping the frisbee on his shirt. He waved back. "Frisbee freaks," Jack said. "I'm sick of them." He lifted the bottle and drank from it, then held it out to Marty. "Go on," he told her. She took a swig. "There's more than beer in here," she said. Jack shrugged. "What's in here?" she asked. "Secret formula," he answered. "Go for two, you're behind." Marty looked at the bottle, then drank again, and passed it to the other man. Even his fingers were brown. He wore a thick wedding ring and a gold chain-link bracelet. She held on to the bottle for an extra moment, long enough for him to notice and give her a look. Then she let go. The hood of his jacket fell back as he tilted his head to drink. Marty saw that he was nearly bald. He had parted his hair just above one ear and swept it sideways to cover the skin on top, which was even darker than the rest of him. "What's your name?" she asked. Jack answered for him. "His name is Jack," he said. The tan one laughed. "Brother," he said, "you are too much." "You aren't from around here," she said. "I would have seen you." He shook his head. "I was running and I ended up here." Jack said, "Don't hog the fuel, Jack," and made a drinking motion with his hand. The tan one nodded. He took a long pull and wiped his mouth and passed the bottle to Jack. Marty stood and brushed off her warm-ups. "Hawaii," she said. "I've always wanted to go to Hawaii. Just kick back for about 3 weeks. Check out the volcanoes. Do some Mai Tais." "Get Lays," Jack said. All three of them laughed. "Well," she said. She touched her toes a couple of times. Jack kept laughing. "Hawaii's amazing," said the other man. "Anything goes." "Stop talking about Hawaii," Jack told him. "It makes me cold." "Me too," Marty said. She rubbed her hands together. "I'm always cold. When I come back, I just hope I come back as a native in some place warm. California, maybe." "Right," Jack said, "bitchin' Cal." But there was something in his voice that made her look over at him. He was studying her. She could tell that he was trying to place her again, trying to recall where he'd met her. She wished she hadn't made that remark about coming back. That was what had set him off. She wasn't even sure she actually believed in it, believed that she was going to return as a different entity later on, someone new and different. She had serious doubts sometimes, but at other times she thought it had to be true. This couldn't be everything. "So," she said, "do you guys know each other?" Jack stared at her a moment longer, then nodded. "All our lives," he said. The tan one shook his head and laughed. "Too much," he said. "We're inseparable," Jack said. "Aren't we, Jack?" The tan one laughed again. "Is that right?" Marty asked him. "Are you inseparable?" He pulled the zipper of his jacket up and down, hiding and then revealing the golden hairs on his chest, though not in a conscious way. His cheeks puffed out and his brow thickened just above his eyes, so that his face seemed heavier. Marty could see that he was thinking. He looked at her and said, "I guess we are, for the time being." "That's fine," she said. "That's all right." That was all right, she thought. She could call Jill. Jill was always up for a party. And if Jill was out or had company, then she'd think of something else. It would work out. "Okay," she said, but before she could say anything else, someone yelled, "Heads up!" And they all looked around. The Frisbee was coming straight at them. Marty felt her body tighten. "Got it," she said, and balanced herself for the catch. Suddenly the breeze gusted and the Frisbee seemed to stop cold, a quivering red line, and then it jerked upwards and flew over their heads and past them. She ran after it, one arm raised, gathering herself to jump, but it stayed just out of reach and finally she gave up. The Frisbee flew a short distance further, then fell to the sidewalk and skidded halfway across the street. Marty scooped it up and flipped it back into the park. She stood there, wanting to laugh, but completely out of breath. Too much weed, she thought. She put her hands on her knees and rocked back and forth. It was quiet. Then, from up the hill, she heard a low rumble that grew steadily louder, and a few seconds later, a big white car came around the corner. Its tires squealed and then went silent as the car slid through a long sheet of water lying in the road. It was moving sideways in her direction. She watched it come. The car cleared the water and the tires began to squeal again, but it kept sliding, and Marty saw the faces inside getting bigger and bigger. There was a girl staring at her from the front window. The girl's mouth was open, her arms braced against the dashboard. Then the tires caught and the car shot forward, so close that Marty could have reached out and touched the girl's cheek as they went past. The car fishtailed down the street. It ran a stop sign at the corner and turned left back up the hill, coughing out bursts of black exhaust. Marty turned toward the park and saw the two men looking at her. They were looking at her as if they had seen her naked, and that was how she felt, naked. She had nearly been killed, and now she was an embarrassment, like someone in need. She wasn't welcome in the park. Marty crossed the street and started up the hill toward her apartment building. She felt as if she were floating, as if there were nothing to her. She passed a gray cat curled up on the hood of a car. There was smoke on the breeze and the smell of decay. It seemed to Marty that she drifted with the smoke through the yellow light, over the dull grass and the brown clumps of leaves. In the park behind her, a boy called football signals, his voice perfectly distinct in the thin, cold air. She climbed the steps to the building but did not go inside. She knew that the dog would bark at her, and she didn't think she could handle that right now. She sat on the steps. From somewhere nearby, a bird cried out in a hoarse, ratcheting voice like chain being jerked through a pulley. Marty did some breathing exercises to get steady, to quiet the fluttering in her shoulders and knees, but she could not calm herself. A few minutes ago, she had nearly been killed, and now there was nobody to talk to about it, to see how afraid she was and tell her not to worry, that it was over now, that she was still alive, that everything was going to be all right. At this moment, sitting here, Marty understood that there was never going to be anyone to tell her these things. She had no idea why this should be so. It was just something she knew. There was no need for her to make a fool of herself again. The sun was going down. Marty couldn't see it from where she sat, but the windows of the house across the street had turned crimson, and the breeze was colder. A broken kite flapped in a tree. Marty fingered the joint in her pocket but left it there. She felt empty and clean and did not want to lose the feeling. She watched the sky darken. Her brother and his friends would be coming off the marsh about now. flushed with cold and drink, their dogs running ahead through the reeds and the tall grass. When they reach the car, they'll compare birds and pass a bottle around. And after the bottle is empty, they will head for the nearest bar, do Boilermakers, stuff themselves with pickled eggs and jerky, throw dice from a leather cup. And outside, in the car, the dogs will be waiting, ears pricked for the least sound, sometimes whimpering to themselves, but mostly silent, tense, and still, watching the bright door the men have closed behind them. It's called The Rich Brother. There were two brothers, Pete and Donald. Pete, the older brother, was in real estate. He and his wife had a Century 21 franchise in Santa Cruz. Pete worked hard and made a lot of money, but not any more than he thought he deserved. He had two daughters, a sailboat, a house from which he could see a thin slice of the ocean, and friends doing well enough in their own lives not to wish bad luck on them. Donald, the younger brother, was still single. He lived alone, painted houses when he found the work, and got deeper in debt to Pete when he didn't. No one would have taken them for brothers. Where Pete was stout and hearty and at home in the world, Donald was bony, grave, and obsessed with the fate of his soul. Over the years, Donald had worn the images of two different perfect masters around his neck. Out of devotion to the second of these, he entered an ashram in Berkeley where he nearly died of undiagnosed hepatitis. By the time Pete finished paying the medical bills, Donald had become a Christian. He drifted from church to church, then joined a Pentecostal community that met somewhere in the Mission District to sing in tongues and swap prophecies. Pete couldn't make sense of it. Their parents were both dead, but while they were alive, neither of them had found it necessary to believe in anything. They managed to be decent people without making fools of themselves, and Pete had the same ambition. He thought that the whole thing was an excuse for Donald to take himself seriously. The trouble was that Donald couldn't content himself with worrying about his own soul. He had to worry about everyone else's, and especially Pete's. He handed down his judgments in ways that he seemed to consider subtle, through significant silence, innuendo, looks of mild despair that said, "Brother, what have you come to?" What Pete had come to, as far as he could tell, was prosperity. That was the real issue between them. Pete prospered, and Donald did not prosper. At the age of 40, Pete took up skydiving. He made his first jump with two friends who'd started only a few months earlier and were already doing stunts. They were both coked to the gills when they jumped, but Pete wanted to do it straight, at least the first time, and he was glad that he did. He would never have used the word mystical, but that was how Pete felt about the experience. Later, he made the mistake of trying to describe it to Donald, who said, "That's just a taste, Pete. Wait till you get high on the real thing." "At least I'm trying something new," Pete told him. "At least I'm breaking the pattern." Not long after that conversation, Donald also broke the pattern by going to live on a farm outside of Paso Robles. The farm was owned by several members of Donald's community who had bought it and moved there with the idea of forming a family of faith. That was how Donald explained it in the first letter he sent. Every week, Pete heard how happy Donald was, how in the Lord. He told Pete that he was praying for him, he and the rest of Pete's brothers and sisters on the farm. "I only have one brother," Pete wanted to answer, "and that's enough." But he kept this thought to himself. In November, the letter stopped. Pete didn't worry about this at first, but when he called Donald at Thanksgiving, Donald was grim. He tried to sound upbeat, but he didn't try hard enough to make it convincing. "Now listen," Pete said, "you don't have to stay in that place if you don't want to." "I'll be all right," Donald answered. "That's not the point. Being all right is not the point. If you don't like what's going on up there, then get out." "I'm all right," Donald said again, more firmly. "I'm doing fine." But he called Pete a week later and said that he was quitting the farm. When Pete asked him where he intended to go, Donald admitted that he had no plan. His car had been repossessed just before he left the city, and he was flat broke. "I guess you'll have to stay with us," Pete said. Donald put up a show of resistance. Then he gave in. "Just until I get my feet on the ground," he said. "Right," Pete said. "Check out your options." He told Donald he'd send him money for a bus ticket, but as they were about to hang up, Pete changed his mind. He knew that Donald would try hitchhiking to save the fare. Pete didn't want him out on the road all alone where some head case could pick him up, where anything could happen to him. Better yet, he said, I'll come and get you. You don't have to do that. I didn't expect you to do that. Donald added, it's a pretty long drive. Just tell me how to get there. But Donald wouldn't give him directions. He said that the farm was too depressing, that Pete wouldn't like it. Instead, he insisted on meeting Pete at a service station called Jonathan's Mechanical Emporium. You must be kidding, Pete said. It's close to the highway, Donald said. I didn't name it. That's one for the collection, Pete said. The day before he left to bring Donald home, Pete received a letter from a man who described himself as head of household at the farm where Donald had been living. From this letter, Pete learned that Donald had not quit the farm, but had been asked to leave. The letter was written on the back of a mimeographed survey form, asking people to record their response to a ceremony of some kind. The last question said, what did you feel during the liturgy? A, being, B, becoming, C, being and becoming, D, none of the above, E, all of the above. He tried to forget the letter, but of course he couldn't. Each time he thought of it, he felt crowded and breathless, a feeling that came over him again when he drove into the service station and saw Donald sitting against a wall with his head on his knees. It was late afternoon. A paper cup tumbled slowly past Donald's feet, pushed by the damp wind. Pete honked, and Donald raised his head. He smiled at Pete, then stood and stretched. His arms were long and thin and white. He wore a red bandana across his forehead, a t-shirt with a couple of words on the front. Pete couldn't read them because the letters were inverted. Grow up, Pete yelled. Get a Mercedes. Donald came up to the window. He bent down and said, thanks for coming. You must be totally whipped. I'll make it, Pete said. I'll make it. Pete pointed at Donald's t-shirt. What's that supposed to say? Donald looked down at his shirt front. Try God. I guess I put it on backwards. Pete, could I borrow a couple of dollars? I owe these people for coffee and sandwiches. Pete took 5 20s from his wallet and held them out the window. Donald stepped back as if horrified. I don't need that much. I can't keep track of all these nickels and dimes, Pete said. Just pay me back when your ship comes in. He waved the bills impatiently. Go on, take it. Only for now. Donald took the money and went into the service station office. He came out carrying 2 orange sodas, one of which he gave to Pete as he got into the car. My treat, he said. No bags? Wow, thanks for reminding me, Donald said. He balanced his drink on the dashboard, but the slight rocking of the car as he got out tipped it onto the passenger seat. Half its contents foamed over before Pete could snatch it up again. Donald looked on while Pete held the bottle out the window, soda running down his fingers. Wipe it up, Pete told him. Quick! With what? Pete stared at Donald. That shirt. Use the shirt. Donald pulled a long face, but did as he was told, his pale skin puckering against the wind. Great, just great, Pete said. We haven't even left the gas station yet. Afterwards, on the highway, Donald said, this is a new car, isn't it? Yes, this is a new car. Is that why you're so upset about the seat? Forget it, okay? Let's just forget about it. I said I was sorry. Pete said, I just wish you'd be more careful. These seats are made of leather. That stain won't come out, not to mention the smell. I don't see why I can't have leather seats that smell like leather instead of orange pop. What was wrong with the other car? Pete glanced over at Donald. Donald had raised the hood of the blue sweatshirt he put on. The peaked hood above his gaunt, watchful face gave him the look of an inquisitor. There wasn't anything wrong with it, Pete said. I just happened to like this one better. Donald nodded. There was a silence between them as Pete drove on and the day darkened toward evening. On either side of the road lay stubble-covered fields. A line of low hills ran along the horizon, topped here and there with trees black against the gray sky. In the approaching line of cars, a driver turned on his headlights. Pete did the same. So what happened, he asked. Farm life not your bag? Donald took some time to answer, and at last he said simply, it was my fault. What was your fault? The whole thing. Don't play dumb, Pete. I know they wrote to you. Donald looked at Pete, then stared out the windshield again. I'm not playing dumb, Pete said after a while. Donald shrugged. All I really know is they asked you to leave, Pete went on. I don't know any of the particulars. I blew it, Donald said. Believe me, you don't want to hear the gory details. Sure I do, Pete said. He added, everybody likes the gory details. You mean everybody likes to hear how someone else messed up? Right, Pete said. That's the way it is here on Spaceship Earth. Donald bent one knee onto the front seat and leaned against the door so that he was facing Pete instead of the windshield. Pete was aware of Donald's scrutiny. He waited. Night was coming on in a rush now, filling the hollows of the land. Donald's long cheeks and deep-set eyes were dark with shadow. His brow was white. Do you ever dream about me? Donald asked. Do I ever dream about you? What kind of a question is that? Of course I don't dream about you, Pete said, untruthfully. What do you dream about? Sex and money. Mostly money. A nightmare is when I dream I don't have any. You're just making that up, Donald said. Pete smiled. Sometimes I wake up at night, Donald went on, and I can tell you're dreaming about me. We were talking about the farm, Pete said. Let's finish that conversation, and then we can talk about our various out-of-body experiences and the interesting things we did during previous incarnations. For a moment, Donald looked like a grinning skull. Then he turned serious again. There's not that much to tell, he said. I just didn't do anything right. That's a little vague, Pete said. Well, like the groceries. Whenever it was my turn to get the groceries, I'd blow it somehow. I'd bring the groceries home and half of them would be missing. Or I'd have all the wrong things, the wrong kind of flour, the wrong kind of chocolate or whatever. One time I gave them away. It's not funny, Pete. Pete said, who did you give the groceries to? Just some people I picked up on the way home, some field workers. They had about 8 kids with them and they didn't even speak English, just nodded their heads. Still, I shouldn't have given away the groceries. Not all of them anyway. I really learned my lesson about that. You have to be practical. You have to be fair to yourself. Donald leaned forward and Pete could sense his excitement. There's nothing actually wrong with being in business, Donald said. As long as you're fair to other people, you can still be fair to yourself. I'm thinking of going into business, Pete. We'll talk about it, Pete said. So that's the story. There isn't any more to it than that. What did they tell you? Donald asked. Nothing. They must have told you something. Pete shook his head. They didn't tell you about the fire? And Pete shook his head again. Donald regarded him for a time, then said, I don't know, it was stupid. I just completely lost it. He pulled at his arms across his chest and slumped back into the corner. Everybody had to take turns cooking dinner. I usually did tuna casserole. But this one night I thought I'd do something different, something really interesting. Donald looked sharply at Pete. It's all a big laugh to you, isn't it? I'm sorry, Pete said. You don't know when to quit. You just keep hitting away. Tell me about the fire, Donald. Donald kept watching him. You have this compulsion to make me look foolish. Come off it, Donald. Don't make a big thing out of this. I know why you do it. It's because you don't have any purpose in life. You're afraid to relate to people who do, so you make fun of them. Relate, Pete said softly. Jesus. You're basically a very frightened individual, Donald said. Very threatened. You've always been like that. Do you remember when you used to try to kill me? I don't have any compulsion to make you look foolish, Donald. You do it yourself. You do it right now. You can't tell me you don't remember, Donald said. It was after my operation. You remember that. Sort of. Pete shrugged. Not really. Oh, yes, Donald said. Do you want to see the scar? I remember you had an operation. I don't remember the specifics, that's all. And I sure as hell don't remember trying to kill you. Oh, yes, Donald repeated maddeningly. You bet your life you did. All the time. The thing was, I couldn't have anything happen to me where they sewed me up because then my intestines would come apart again and poison me. That was a big issue, Pete. Mom was always in a state about me climbing trees and so on, and you used to hit me there every chance you got. Mom was in a state every time you burped, Pete said. I don't know. Maybe I bumped into you accidentally once or twice. I never did it deliberately. Every chance you got, Donald said. Like when the folks went out at night and left you to babysit. I'd hear them say goodnight, and then I'd hear the car start up. And when they were gone, I'd lie there and listen. After a while, I would hear you coming down the hall, and I would close my eyes and pretend to be asleep. There were nights when you would stand outside the door, just stand there, and then go away again. But most nights you'd open the door, and I would hear you in the room with me, breathing. You'd come over and sit next to me on the bed. You remember, Pete. You have to. You'd sit next to me on the bed and pull the sheets back. If I was on my stomach, you'd roll me over. Then you'd lift up my pajama shirt and start hitting me on my stitches. You'd hit me as hard as you could, over and over, and I would just keep lying there with my eyes closed. I was afraid that you'd get mad if you knew I was awake. Is that strange or what? I was afraid that you'd get mad if you found out that I knew you were trying to kill me. Donald laughed. Come on, you can't tell me you don't remember that.